We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus. I'm Tom Rogers, and for David Inge, this is our morning talk program. And every once in a while on the show, we bring in some regulars to answer your questions that you may have about certain topics. And today, it is the monthly visit by Scott Spies, Spies Home Inspection Service, and we're here to talk about home repair and home maintenance. And always seems to get a lot of questions, and I know, Scott, that this is the time of year that people are most gung-ho, I guess, about getting some stuff done.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for letting me come out today. Yeah, with all the rain and stuff we've got, a lot of outdoor activities. Everybody wants to get out there in the sun and play around and get out in the yard. And, okay, what do I got to do to take care of my siding and make my yard look better at the same time? So all sorts of things we can talk about today.
All the honeydew projects come out this time of year. It is honeydew season. So we are asking you for your questions, and your questions are certainly welcome on this program about home repair and home maintenance. Our numbers are 333-9455. That's the local number. Toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. Now, I don't have access at the moment to the email account, unfortunately, so we can't take some email questions this morning. But if you have access to a phone, that would be perfect. 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. And, Scott, looks like we may already have a call, I believe. Why don't we head over to line one? Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Our roofing contractor, Geyer Roofing, did not apply a first course of asphalt shingles prior to applying new shingles. Now, what's unique is the new shingles have tabs that expose about 3 to 6 inches of the course below it. They're called GAF Grand Sequoia. The first course is about 26 years old. And it's deteriorated. In fact, many shingles are curled, cracked, split, and many are almost devoid of granules. So what's your opinion of cementing, using roofing cement to cement new shingles, just cut to fit the 3 to 6 inch spaces between the tabs to cover the deteriorated shingles?
I'm not sure I understand what 3 to 6 inch space that we're referring to here.
Oh, it's between the tabs. On normal shingles, though, the tabs are there's a space between a tab maybe half an inch or less.
Yeah, about 3/8 of an inch. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, these shingles, the tabs are like 3 to 6 inches apart.
No, I don't think. Well, that would not make sense, in that most of the newer shingles are what we call an architectural shingle, and what they'll do is they'll have a new tab, and then they'll have decorative tabs on top of the main tab, so that it looks like there's a space. It's actually designed to look more like a shake roof or a slate-type roof. It's supposed to give the roof some texture. But the shingles themselves should not have that wide of a gap. Matter of fact, most of the new shingles have almost no gap or no cut in between the shingles.
Well, all I can tell you is that the first course of shingles. Now on one side of the garage, the first course of shingles is new. On the other three sides of the garage, the space between the tabs is the old shingle.
Okay.
And like I said, and it's deteriorating.
Yeah. Well, it would if the old shingle is still exposed. The old shingle has given us a good full life of, as you indicated, about 25 or 26 years. And so it is about due to be replaced or to covered to help protect it. The mineral granules on the shingles are actually the UV protectant to help keep the sunlight from deteriorating the asphalt, which impregnates the either fiberglass or organic mat.
Yeah.
And so once those granules start coming off, yes, the shingle starts wearing from sunlight. And so that's when it's time to put a new covering over it.
Yeah.
I'm a little puzzled as to the type of gap that you're referring to. That would not be what I'd consider normal. That's something we may actually have to have somebody take a look at and actually get a feel for what's going on. It's not impossible that what happened is we have some defective shingles. The factory shingles may have been defective batch. And what you're seeing is the decorative tabs and then the new shingles actually wearing faster than what it should. But like I say, without actually seeing it, I'm not sure that I could make a positive comment on how to take care of it.
Well, okay.
All right.
Let's say that I was to take where these places are where the exposed first core shingle is deteriorated. I was to take a new shingle and just cut it to fit that place and use roofing cement to put it in place. Is that problem?
If you've got an area where, if you're talking about just a starter course right along the edge of the gutter? Yeah.
Well, it's actually I don't know whether you call it a starter course. It's a first course anyway. But,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes, you can actually get it if you cut a tab and slide it in there, and roofing cement will hold it, and if that will give you the proper protection. What you have to make sure is that water can't back up behind it. In other words, that we don't, if you're trying to put it under the shingles, that we're not getting a lip or a raised edge. But, yeah, it is acceptable to take tabs and cut off the back half so you've got just the decorative portion and cement those in place.
Okay. But it's important to have that roofing cement right up at the top of it, huh?
Yeah, because you need to make sure water doesn't wick in behind it because then it'll deteriorate prematurely.
Yeah, okay.
All right.
So are there any other roof recommended solutions to the problem?
Like I say, again, without seeing it, I'm not sure exactly what it would take to do that.
Yeah. Do you have, what recourse does a homeowner have when a contractor like Guy Roofing doesn't comply with the terms and conditions of the contract and refuses to correct the shoddy workmanship?
Well, there again, you would have to get a couple of other opinions and usually have to get something in writing from another roofing company or from an inspection company. And then, of course, your best bet is to go directly to the roofing company in question and say, this is what we found out. If there's a problem, then, of course, we have to involve lawyers.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, I've gone to the Better Business Bureau, Attorney General, and also...
actually, this is probably a question that's better suited toward a legal show and
okay.
Not a show about home repair.
Okay.
But, all right,
well,
thanks for your call. 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. And we head on to a caller in Champaign on line two. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have a couple of questions about the care of plaster walls. So we're fairly new homeowners, and unfortunately, our plaster walls came to us with several nail holes around which the plaster is kind of shattered away. And we do have also a couple of smallish superficial cracks in the wall. So one of my questions is, what is the best way to go about repairing that damage? And then my second question is, we would like to hang a couple of fairly heavy items from our walls once we have those repairs done and we're all repainted. The items are some decorative sort of cast iron grates. So they are a little bit heavy, and we're interested in hanging those items, obviously, without causing further damage to the plaster. So those are my two questions, and I'll take your answers off the air.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, plaster is an older product. It was done in houses usually prior to 1950. And as it gets older, it ages and gets more brittle. So, yes, when you go to put in a nail hole now, it sort of looks like a BB that hits a glass window. It makes a little hole, and then you end up with this great big beveled area that falls out. And that's because the plaster is drying. It's a concrete type of a texture. There are several different spackling compounds. If you've got small areas, then yes, you can put in a little bit of drywall compound or spackling, which is designed for patching small areas. For larger areas, there's a definite technique to putting on plaster and getting it to look right, and we don't have as many skilled craftsmen as we used to in that particular field because there's not as much of it out there being done in this area. Now you get up around Chicago, and it's amazing how many plaster people are up there. But in Champaign-Urbana area, we don't have as many people that work with plaster and do a good job of repair. So you're going to probably get a little bit practice on your own. You can look up some things on the internet on plaster repair, but for the most part, it's a matter of mixing up a repair material, spackling or a drywall mud, or even a thin or fine course of plaster itself, and going over the areas and then sand them down lightly before painting. As far as hanging heavy stuff, originally plaster walls would have a picture mold or a crown mold at the top of the ceiling. Now, the picture mold had a curved surface at the top, and they made a hook that would go over the top of the crown mold, and then you would run a cable down and hang whatever you want off a cable. So rather than putting nails in the wall, your pictures were actually suspended off of cables off of that wood molding at the very top of the wall. So if you've got the picture mold, then what we do is find a couple of picture hanging hooks. They're usually brass, nice and shiny looking, and that way you can use a picture wire and hang things. If you actually have to go into the plaster, you're probably going to end up with the same breakouts that you've got now, but I would recommend starting out with a small masonry bit and drill a pilot hole. Try and make sure that you're finding a wall stud, because if you're hanging anything heavy, we don't really want it hanging off of the plaster lath. Again, the plaster is old enough that we start flexing the lath that it's attached to, and we can start breaking off large sections. Plaster, when it's installed, is put over either a metal lath or a wood lath, and it's put on wet, and it oozes through the slats in the lath or through the metal mesh and dries and creates the plaster keys, which actually hold it in place. If we start breaking off the plaster keys or we start flexing things, then the skim coat or the top coat of the plaster can start to break off. So we got to be pretty careful when hanging the heavy stuff. Ideally, the picture mold, the trim. Otherwise, a small masonry bit, get yourself through the plaster and make sure you find a wall stud to actually put a bolt through.
So it's hard to find people who are expert in plaster repairing.
It is, because there's just not as much repair going on. More people are covering with drywall. That's the
common. They just cover
repair.
It up completely, or they don't take it out or anything.
Yeah, well, you can do it either way. If you're doing a complete renovation on the home, then yes, you could take it out, but that is just messier than all get out. It's unbelievable how much stuff is in the walls or in behind there and how much dust it makes taking it down. So a lot of the repairs is just to use a thin layer of drywall and a longer drywall screw and get something that's long enough to go all the way into the lath and screw the drywall right over the top of it.
But if you're looking at historic preservation, then you know, you've got to find somebody who's got some expertise.
Yeah, and it's not easy to do. When you find the plaster guys, hold on to them because they're hard to find.
All right. 222, or check that, 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Your home repair and home maintenance questions for Scott Spies on this Monday Morning Focus. We move on to line 4 and a caller in Pennsylvania. Good morning.
Hi, I'm actually calling about our house in Champaign that
needs
some more insulation in the attic. It has fiberglass mats right now, but we also run a whole house fan. And I've heard you mention that, you know, if you've already got fiberglass, it's not a bad idea to blow in insulation because it'll, I guess, you know, help with some of the gaps that the bats might leave. But can you really blow in if you use a whole house fan?
Yeah, the whole house fan generally does not create enough turbulence inside the attic to disturb the insulation itself. The whole house fan is drawing the air up through the ceiling and blowing it up into the attic, and it very rarely is it actually aimed or pointed at any of the insulation, particularly if the insulation, you know, if the fan is mounted flat in the ceiling, blowing up. Now, occasionally we'll find a whole house fan that is mounted vertically, and then they just have an air chute or something coming up from the ceiling, and that you'd probably want to put some cardboard or something in front of the fan so it doesn't move the insulation. But if it's a normal installation or the more common installation, putting a little bit of loose fill over the top of it is not going to hurt anything. And you're absolutely correct. When you've already got a fiberglass bat, throwing a little bit of loose fill over the top will actually help the performance of the bats, because it does fill in the inevitable gaps that we get between the bats.
Okay, and then also, I've read that in the wintertime you should probably have some type of cover for the fan so you're not losing heat through the ceiling up into the attic. Is there anything in particular you do or don't recommend as far as those covers go?
Kind of depends on how easy it is to get to the attic and get above the fan. It's not that difficult to take a couple of pieces of sheet styrofoam and build yourself a styrofoam box that you can set down over the top of the fan from above.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen people take quilts or blankets and put them over the top. If you do that, you need to make sure you disconnect everything electrically so that we don't get anything that would come on and suck that blanket in or get too hot. But the foam cover over the top, now if you can't get to the attic area easily to put something over the top of it, then you can make yourself a cover that goes on the inside or from the hallway. Most of the time the grates are metallic. You can get a magnetic sign material that they use for putting magnetic signs on cars and cut it to fit that, and it goes over the top of it, and that helps reduce airflow up through there and holds itself in place. Or you could even build a small wooden frame that would go up with a couple of clips. And it doesn't require a lot of insulation to really make a big difference. When it's with no covering over it, we've got these little 16th of an inch metal slots that don't fit, or metal slats that don't fit tightly together, and we get a lot of air movement through there. So every little bit will make a big difference.
Okay, real good. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. I'm surprised that whole house fans aren't made with some sort of automatic insulation things for an off season.
Well,
that those slats may not, you know, they don't fit that close together.
They don't, and it's because they have to be lightweight, because the only mechanism for opening the slats is the airflow through there, and if they're too heavy, then the fan can't draw enough air through it. I'm sure that a lot of the manufacturers will sell covers, but it's usually just as easy to make your own.
Right.
And depending on your application as to how easy it is to get to, whether you put one in on the interior or the exterior. It's amazing how whole house fans really aren't as popular as they used to be. We get them in a lot of the older houses, but most of the newer houses that don't have the high ceilings are not quite as effective as what they were in the old houses.
And they find the other ways to vent the attic.
Yeah.
All right. Let's head on to Tuscola and a call on line one. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a roofing question. I have a roofing contractor that's going to do a complete tear off and a re-roof and shingle job. And he's planning on using 15-pound felt paper as opposed to 30. And his reasoning is that the shingles seem to lay better. And I was wondering what your thoughts were on that.
Well, the underlayment is designed to give us a little added barrier. As long as you're putting a good quality shingle over it, I don't see a problem with the 15-pound roofing felt. The 30-pound would be more what I would use underneath a slate or a tile or a wood shake roof. With an asphalt shingle, I think the 15-pound should be adequate.
Okay, that answers my question. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks for your call. 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. And if we have a little time, I like to talk about, you know, how do you know when it's time to get a new roof, aside from the leaking? You know, if you're putting buckets in the house, that's one indicator.
You may want to know before that.
Yeah. Let's go on to line two. We have a call from Decatur. Good morning.
Morning. I have a question about cleaning walls after new construction. We've moved all the saws out and everything, and we're about ready to move in. A lot of dust on the walls, and we're about to do touch-up, but I don't want to scratch the walls. Someone suggested using a push broom with fine bristles and putting it in a pillowcase. I didn't know if there was a better way to clean the walls so that the new paint doesn't get scratched. So that's my question.
Well, I do know that in the automotive industry, they use what they call a tack cloth, and it is just exactly that. It is a cloth which has a sticky adhesive on it, not so much that it's going to stick to anything and leave a residue, but it's definitely going to pick up any dust, and they use that for getting perfect finishes on cars, and there's no reason why you couldn't use something similar to that. I believe there are several products out there right now for doing dusting that have lint trapping capabilities. You don't want necessarily to use something like a pledge where it would transfer the walls, but I know a lot of the cleaning products out there have just a little bit of static that will help pick it up, and some of them are a little on the sticky side. Otherwise, you break down and go over to the automotive parts store and ask for some tack cloths for the paint, and wrap that around your broom or around whatever, and it will pick up most of the dust. I probably would try a shop vac and see if I can get most of it up with a shop vac first, but you have to make sure you've got a really good filter. Otherwise, that stuff is just fine, and if it blows back out the other end of the shop vac,
you've got another job. Yeah.
You would use a shop vac and not like a filter queen or like a regular vacuum cleaner that has a pretty good filter on it?
Well, the problem with those is most of them aren't intended for that much dust and dirt, the construction-type dirt, and some of the larger particles, because you're vacuuming, occasionally you get something up off the floor or something like that. And the problem we run into is if you get a good filter, it blocks up so fast you can't get anywhere. You end up, you vacuum 4 feet, and you got to go out there and dump the filter because it gets blocked up with dust. So you need something that's got more of a through flow, such as, a shop vac.
Right, and so this tack cloth, it's something you can rub the surface and it'll just pick it up?
Yep, that's what it does. It's got just enough adhesive to it. It'll pick up just about any dust and dirt and leave you with a nice, clean finish.
Okay, great. All right, thanks a lot.
All right, thanks for your call. I guess, I would share the same concern about, what the effect might be on the paint, but we're talking about auto paint, which is probably a little more resistant than the paint you have in your house. But.
Well, the tack cloth doesn't actually have enough adhesive to transfer to anything.
Uh-huh.
And in the automotive industry, of course, we're going for a mirror finish, where in a house we don't have to have it anywhere near that smooth, because we're not trying to get a smooth surface. We want more of a flat surface or even a textured surface.
So cross purposes
sometimes
work. 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455 for your home repair and home maintenance questions for Scott Spies. Right now, Terre Haute is on line four. Good morning.
Good morning. Mr. Spies, a couple questions about gutters. Our house is about 20 years old, and we get a lot of excess water going over the gutter, so I'm assuming that the downspouts are clogged. So I had a question about unclogging those. They all feed into drain lines that drain off the property. And the other question is that in a number of places we get water dripping down behind the gutter, so obviously the gutter's coming away from the house. Recommendations for those two problems?
All right. Normally, if you've got water dripping behind the gutter, then when the gutter was installed, it was either installed on the top of the drip edge or below the drip edge. Now, the drip edge is a piece of metal that they attach the roof before they shingle. It sticks out and has an overhang of about an inch or so, about a half an inch or so, just to let water drip off the front. Sort of like pouring soda pop out of a pitcher. If the pitcher has a little chip in it, the water follows in behind it. If it's done properly, it just pours off. This drip edge is designed to let the water drip off the front edge rather than roll back. When they put the gutter on, they're supposed to tuck the back of the gutter behind the drip edge. There are times, depending on locations, where the gutter has, in order to keep a slope, at one end it's behind the drip edge, and at the other end it's lower than what the drip edge is. In that case, what we do is we cut a small piece of aluminum flashing, and we tuck it behind the drip edge and then back over the top of the gutter. That way there's no way that water can get in behind the gutter. Because once it is behind the gutter, we end up with rapid deterioration of the fascia board and even some possible damage to the end of the rafter tails, because that moisture gets held against the fascia, or the fascia gets damp.
Right, rotten wood.
Yeah. So first thing I would do is get up there and take a look and see if the drip edge is over the top of the gutter. If it's not, then we need to either pry the drip edge up and get it over the top, or we try and loosen the gutter and drop it down and then slide it up in behind it. If for some reason or another it's been mounted lower than the drip edge, then you can go get yourself some aluminum flashing and cut it to the proper width. Usually 1.5 or 2 inches is more than adequate. And you can slide it in behind the drip edge over the top of the gutter, and one nail every few feet should hold it in place.
Okay. And the downspout issue with the...
Well, as far as overflowing, I know in central Illinois and central Indiana, we get these rains that come down so hard that there just is no gutter system that's going to hold them. So we're going to get some overflow. Make sure that the downspouts are cleaned out. Make sure we don't have any blockage. Look for anything that might be directing the water over the front edge of the gutter. such as if somebody did not cut the shingles back far enough, so where the shingle overhangs too far into the gutter.
Okay.
The shingle should not need to overhang anything farther than what the drip edge is. And I've seen some that were installed where they cover half the gutter because somebody didn't, usually when it's a second layer, somebody didn't put the starter course on correctly, and they end up sticking way out in the gutter, and that can cause a problem. For the most part, you may need to you need to empty that gutter, and if it's overflowing, you may need to put a couple more downspouts in and get a little bit more water out.
And
they do make a commercial size guttering as well. So if we have really large roof expanses and a lot of water, we can go from the standard 6-inch gutter to an 8-inch gutter, or is it 4-inch? It's a 4-inch gutter to a 6-inch gutter.
All right, thanks so much.
Thanks for your call. We've got more time for more questions at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455, including this call coming in from Urbana on line one. Good morning.
Hi, I have another question on insulation. I've got a 1952 kind of large Cape Cod, so my second floor bedrooms are in the attic, basically. I have the top attics and the side attics. The bedrooms on the second floor are 10 to 15 degrees warmer than the first floor, and I've done some investigation, and it seems like my three problems are I have original bat insulation from the 50s that's compressed down to about 4 inches. I don't have any vents on the side attics, and there's no air conditioning return on the second floor, and I got a quote of about $450 for an air conditioning return. Can you tell me which of those might actually produce the most benefit in trying to help me cool off my second floor?
Well, unfortunately, the answer is yes, yes, and yes.
Okay. Great.
Yeah, all of those are going to be helpful. Depending on the temperature of the attic is going to change whether or not the ventilation and the insulation makes a big difference. If your attic areas are already relatively cool, in other words, we've already got some reasonable ventilation in the upper portion, then they're not going to help as much. But if the attic seems to get quite hot and stuffy and gets up, 130, 140 degrees, and we've got 4 inches of insulation, yes, some of that heat will radiate through the insulation back down. If you've got room for more volume, I would really like to see probably 10 to 12 inches of insulation up there. If I know a lot of roof styles such as what you're talking about, we just don't have the room for volume or a lot of insulation. We can try some of the reflective insulation. Now, reflective insulation does not work really well relative to volume or thickness, but in areas where we are limited in our thickness, it works much better than having little or no insulation. And it's basically a foil or reflective-faced insulation that will help reflect heat so that the heat does not mitigate down into the house. Again, ventilation will help, whether or not you use a roof vent or soffit vents or a combination or even ridge vents at the very top if your sidewalls are vented well enough up to the top. Kind of depends on the house construction. The return air is important, but not necessarily as important as the supply air. What happens with air conditioning, of course, cold air is heavier, so it wants to fall. You put the cold air in upstairs, it wants to drop down. Well, when it drops down, that means all the warm air from downstairs has to come up, because we can't just have a void. We've got to have some circulation. So you end up with a natural convection. All the heat in the house wants to go to the second floor. Yeah, it's nice to have a return to suck it back down, but it just about is important. We need to probably start dampering down some of the rooms on the first floor so that we're forcing more of the cold air upstairs to try and get the temperature to drop.
Okay.
And that will help almost as much as having the return air trying to draw the warmer air off the top.
Okay. On the insulation, I do have enough room in the top attic and the side attics for some blown-in insulation or more bats. I have not quite figured out, though, on the vertical knee walls, How does one insulate a knee wall that already has a bat in the space?
Well, that would be the place where the reflective insulation might pay off, because it would be just a thin sheet that we could then staple in place. Otherwise, they do make bat-type insulation in 4 foot wide that we can use to basically nails into the studs, the visible studs, and kind of hang the insulation over the top. When adding another layer of insulation, you don't necessarily want a vapor barrier, so you want to use an unfaced fiberglass if you're going to use a bat in that particular instance. But yeah, the knee wall areas, you end up with about 3.5. That's one of the places where the reflective insulation may help pay off.
Great. Thank you for your help.
And thanks for your call. We take one more call before the break, and this one comes from Rushville. Good morning. Line 2.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, you know, I've got another question about gutters and downspouts and just water in general coming around the house. Now, a lot of people have problems around here lately where I'm at with flooded basements and whatnot, and it's because they don't have their gutters, their downspouts far enough away. Some people just lay it next to the house and let it run off at that little corner. It's only like a foot lengthwise. I was telling people they need to go at least 4 or 5 feet away from the house because they're starting to lose, they're recycling the water. I was just wondering what's your recommendation. Oh, the other thing is too, landscaping around the outside of the house. A lot of them are older houses. They're 50, 60 plus years. All that debris has gotten down into now their drain tiles. What do you suggest and how do you, what's a more efficient way of getting rid of it? I'll get off and listen. Thank you.
All right. Well, I'll take the first part and see if I can't explain that. My recommendations are if you've got a crawl space that you need to get the water about 3 feet away from the foundation before it actually hits the soil and can soak back down because it can filter back towards the house. If you've got a basement, I like to see it at least 5 feet out and away. Now, it's in the BOCA codes, building codes, but I haven't found too many building inspectors that enforce it. The grading around the house from the bottom of your siding to the soil should be a gap of about 4 to 6 inches. So you should see 4 to 6 inches of your masonry foundation. From that point to a point 10 feet out in the yard, you should have another 6 to 8 inches of drop. So basically from the bottom of the siding to a spot 10 feet out in the yard, you should have anywhere from 10 to 15 inches, 10 to 14 inches of slope. So basically the house is on a hill. I would say there are fewer than 5% of the houses that I inspect that have this proper hill. And the ones that do seem to have drier crawl spaces and drier basements. So, yes, drainage is very important. The downspout extensions is very important. But downspout extension is only part of it because of the aforementioned problem where we had water running over the gutters. We have these huge rains that dump inches of water in minutes that the gutters just can't handle. It's going to overflow the gutter. It's going to fall down next to the foundation. If the foundation has the soil settled around it, which is common, we end up with this moat effect that holds that water, and that water then soaks down next to the foundation. So a little bit of landscaping to get a slope away from the house does make a huge difference in how dry the basement or how dry the crawl space is. I can't say it's going to correct 100% because we do have these interesting clay layers in our subsoils in our area. So I won't say it works on every house, but for the most part, drainage and exterior drainage and downspouts are the key for the dry crawl space and the dry basement.
All right. Home repair and home maintenance, our topics this morning on Focus. And our guest is Scott Spies, Spies Home Inspection Service. And he's answering your calls at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Let's take a short break right here. This is Focus.
The countdown to the end of our fiscal year has begun. Our task this last month is to reach our membership goal of $2.1 million. Together, we've worked through significant challenges this year, and together we can close the gap and reach our fundraising goal by June 30th. Please mail a check to 300 North Goodwin, Urbana, Illinois, 61801. Thank you.
It's Focus on WILL AM 580. I'm Tom Rogers in for David Inge, and Scott Spies is our guest. And this is our monthly show about home repair and home maintenance. Your questions are welcome at 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. Oh, if you want to finish the last one, go ahead.
Okay. Well, yeah, the second part of his question, that the last caller, was what to do about drainage tiles that have blocked up.
That it was speaking of landscaping, old landscaping.
Well, what happened is a lot of the old homes, they actually had a perimeter tile that they ran their downspouts to the perimeter tile and would run it to a storm sewer to drain it out. Mm-hmm. Those tiles usually lasted about 25 to 30 years and then would start breaking up or filling with debris. Now, if you have your downspout connected to one of these buried tiles, you're force feeding all that water right next to the foundation. So, yes, I do recommend on the older homes that have the drainage systems to get the downspouts out of those old clay tiles and run across on the surface. Now, the newer homes were with a PVC. PVC does not deteriorate like the clay did, so we don't have any problems with the PVC drainage systems.
They still build those types of drainage systems, too. It's not because I hear a lot about, well, you should be draining your stuff out, you know, maybe overground anyway.
In areas where there have known drainage issues, yes, they still do some tiling, but it's usually done with a flexible, either a PVC or a polycarbonate plastic black drainage tile. So if you've got a plastic or a PVC-type drainage tile, then you're probably still in good shape.
And certainly nothing draining into the storm sewer.
Well, theoretically, you're not supposed to drain into the storm sewer. You're supposed to put everything off to the surface.
Right.
So.
All right. 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. And before I get to our next call, somebody did call and say that we're talking about hanging stuff on plaster walls.
Uh-huh.
And he says you can go to the True Value Round Barn Center and buy those hooks to hang on the molding, on the picture molding
for the plaster. The picture hooks, yeah.
People still make them. Mm-hmm. So I hope that's of help to you. Line one right now on our show for Scott Spies in Champaign. Good morning.
Hi. I have a question. Once in a while, it seems like when it gets really humid outside, our windows, some of the windows in the house, start to get water condensation on them, and it's like causing problem with the wood windowsills. We keep the temperature at about between 70 and 72,
mm-hmm.
What do you think? What's going on?
You're getting condensation on the windows in the summertime?
Yes, in the summertime.
Okay, well, your windows are quite cold. and is condensation on the inside or the outside?
The inside. We get it in the wintertime, too, but in the summertime when it gets kind of really humid, we start getting it in some of the rooms.
We need to figure out where the moisture source is. In order for condensation, the window has to be the cold spot.
Okay.
Before water will condense on it. Water, once it evaporates, of course, becomes a water vapor, and water vapor moves by vapor pressure, and vapor pressure will try and equalize throughout the entire house. If we have a cold spot, the cold air won't hold the moisture, so we start getting condensation. So condensation in the summertime is extremely unusual because generally the windows are not the cold area where the water would start to condense. Usually the windows, because of the outdoor temperatures and the poor insulating quality, usually the windows are one of the warmer areas. So if you actually have water condensing on the windows, my guess is you've got air conditioning blowing directly on those windows.
Okay.
But I also think you probably have just an excessively high humidity level in the house. We need to figure out where that moisture is coming from. You might try getting an inexpensive hygrometer, basically a moisture meter. Available at several of the local hobby stores, Radio Shack type places, or even some of the decorating places, the barometers and the hygrometers and things like that. Put it in there and see what percentage we're actually working with. I mean, if the house is in the 50 or 60% moisture range, then we're probably normal. If it's sitting around 75 or 80% moisture range or a little bit higher, then we probably have a moisture source that's actually creating the problem.
Okay, so 50 to 60 is okay, and what's too high, I'm sorry?
Anything above 60 I usually figure is too high.
Okay.
And in the summertime. Now, in the wintertime, it's going to want to go the other way because the cold air outside doesn't have as much moisture in it, so we try and keep the house somewhere in the 25 to 45% range.
Okay. And if I do find out that the humidity is too high, who do I call?
Home inspector is an ideal place to call because they're not trying to make a profit off of finding anything. They're just trying to get to the root of the problem and let you know what's going on.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
All right. And thanks for your call. Now, obviously, central air systems are supposed to pull some of that humidity out of the house.
Exactly.
Anyway.
Yes. Which is why a condensation in the summertime is a very rare occurrence and usually only in a house that has a significant moisture problem.
So it could be an air conditioner problem?
Not necessarily an air conditioner problem, but we may have a faulty power humidifier that's putting in moisture even in the summertime. We could be trying to run the fan on the air conditioner continuous. I don't recommend keeping the fan in the on position when you run the air conditioner because whenever the compressor shuts off, if we keep blowing air past the evaporator, we end up evaporating the moisture that it pulled out of the house, re-evaporate it, put it back into the house.
Blowing the humidity back in.
And so then it has to work twice as hard to pull it back out again. So the fan on your central air system should be in the auto position unless the compressor is not running. I know on the nice cool nights when it's nice out, we're going to get some air circulation. We can turn the compressor off and turn the fan on for just to move the air around the house.
But you may want to make sure that compressor hasn't been working and there isn't, you know, condensation.
Yeah, we don't want that. Yeah, because if the water is sitting on the evaporator and we evaporate it back into the house, it's going to feel muggy.
Counterproductive. All right, let's head to line two. Good morning, line two. You are on a cell phone, line two.
Okay.
There you are.
Okay. I had you talking about roofing earlier. I've roofed like two or three houses and had pretty good luck with them. But my question was the comparison and the cost between a regular asphalt or fiberglass shingle roof and the new metal roofs that are pretty popular, the non-exposed screw metal roofs. What's the cost and the life expectancy compare, you know, between the two of them?
Well, I haven't done a lot of research on the metal roofs. They are starting to become a little bit more popular. My concern with them, and it's unfounded at the moment because I haven't been able to do enough research on it, is moisture condensation. When you have a metal roof, it's going to get cold in the wintertime. And if we have any humidity in the house, it's going to want to condense on the first cold surface. You're going to end up with water condensing on the back of it. So I'm a little worried about what we're doing as far as vapor barriers between the metal roof and the house to make sure that we don't get that condensation on the back of that metal roof. I know in large metal farm buildings, condensation on the inside of the metal buildings has been a big issue. And I know at one point in time, you'll find a few of them here in Champaign-Urbana, we had some all-steel houses. They had steel-covered foam panel walls, steel roofing, and they actually had a gutter that they built inside the attic. So when the condensation ran down the steel roofing, it collected in this gutter and drained it to the outside. So I'm a little concerned about on some of these metal roofs on what we're doing as far as keeping the moisture from condensing on the backside and creating all sorts of mold, mildew, or deterioration problems.
A lot of the industrial buildings have metal roofs on them, but they're insulated. They put down a fiberglass mat first and then put down the metal roof over that. The nice thing about metal roof, it, to me, I live out in the country, is the wind resistance. You know, you don't have the shingles blowing up.
You're right, but with the metal roof, you got to pay good attention to vapor barrier and insulation because the requirements are going to be different than if we're going to use an asphalt shingle.
I was just curious about the lifespan and the cost.
I really haven't done enough research on the cost. I haven't run across enough of those in the home inspection business yet.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Got a couple more minutes here for a few more calls, about 10 more minutes or so. Heading off to Lafayette, Indiana on line four. Good morning.
Hello. What can I do to free a old double-hung window? It's in the garage. It hasn't moved in years and probably won't.
You're right. They're probably been painted several times and are stuck in place.
No, these are inside the garage.
Oh, okay. And it's just stuck to where it doesn't move?
Mm-hmm.
Usually you'll have to pull the stop trim off depending on what you've got. If they're really stuck, you pull the stop trim off the front. It's a relatively thin trim strip that basically holds the window in place. And usually it'll pry off without breaking, and you can wiggle the window loose to get it to come loose, because I'm guessing that it's just got some debris in there, moisture and such, and the wood is stuck, so you may have to pull the window forward.
Could there be warping involved, too, though?
It's possible, but if it was painted, it probably shouldn't have warped.
Uh-huh.
Usually what I'll find is that when somebody's painted it from the outside, they're painted stuck. They do make a kind of a heart-shaped trowel with a serrated edge, that you can run between the stop trim and the window to try and break anything loose there. But if that doesn't take care of it, then you'll probably have to remove the stop trim and pull the windows forward.
Okay. And how do I clean it up or lubricate the track?
I'm assuming we're talking a wood window?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, just a little bit of sandpaper to clean it right up, and once you got a good coat of paint on it, it shouldn't take a whole lot of lubrication. If you wanted to put something on it, like a furniture polish, like a Lemon Pledge type spray, does have enough oils in it to be able to allow the window to move up and down without soaking into the wood.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call. We've got still time to get your call in if you want to call 1-800-222-9455 or 333-9455 for Scott's piece and the topic of home repair and home maintenance. Call right now on line one in Champaign. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi. I recently had a home energy audit, and they used the blower door testing and air sealing.
Mm-hmm.
They came up with two recommendations for me, and one was to seal up my crawl space. The other was in the attic where they would do some sealing, and I guess they would box areas where we have canned lights and that type of thing. I've had two estimates on having the work done, and I asked them to kind of prioritize the work to be done since it's several thousands of dollars. One of the recommendations was to do the crawl space first. The other recommendation was to do the attic first, and I'm wondering what your opinion would be.
Well, crawl spaces, I don't know if sealing the crawl space is a good idea, depending on the crawl space. If you have a very, very dry crawl space, you have proper grading around the outside, downspout extensions, etc., then we could do some sealing of the crawl space. But very little heat loss goes up, so the crawl space is going to be the last place you're going to lose heat.
Okay.
Most of your heat loss is going through the ceiling. Insulating around your can lights is a good idea. Different can lights have different ratings. Some of them have an IC rating, which is, means in contact, which means you can actually put insulation right in contact with the can light.
Mm-hmm.
Other ones require an airspace, and when they require an airspace, then we have to build some type of box around it to give it adequate cooling, and then throw the insulation over the top of the box. Since we are worried primarily, we have more heating days than we have cooling days here, I would start with the attic area.
Okay.
Because more heat is going to be lost upward than downward.
Great.
The crawl space is generally 55 degrees pretty much year-round. The soil underneath the house, since it's not exposed to outdoor temperatures, the earth is going to be about 55 degrees. So it really, it's almost a heat sink in the cooling season. It helps pull some of the heat out of the house. And 55 degrees in the wintertime is almost a heat source.
So what would be the purpose, then, of sealing a crawl space?
Well, the crawl space, you don't want to have a lot of outside air coming in the wintertime. We don't want to have frozen pipes. We don't want to have cold air coming in there. In the summertime, we don't want the humidity. When we have, you know, 85%, 90% humid days, and we've got all of our air conditioning ductwork running through the crawl space, we really don't want that warm air coming in there and getting condensation on our ductwork. So in the spring and fall, we can kind of open them up and let them air out. But generally, you don't have a lot of heat loss through that crawl space. It's almost a heat source. So I would say definitely in your case, start with the attic area.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for your call. We may be able to slip one more call in before the end of the show, but I did want to get in, the question we had earlier about you start seeing those granules in your gutter, and you think, "Oh my goodness, here goes my roof." But that's not necessarily
worrying. Usually, when they make the shingles, it goes through a process where we start with either an organic or a fiberglass mat. We then impregnate it or saturate it with an asphalt mixture,
mm-hmm.
and then we then put the mineral granules or rocks on top of that, and they put them over the top of it, and it soaks into the asphalt and is bonded. So we can get the shingles new. They've got a lot of loose pellets or a lot of loose granules because not all of them bonded to the roof. So
they don't shake them out a whole lot when they leave the factory.
Yeah. Most of the time when you look in the gutter, a new roof will have a lot of granules in the gutter.
Uh-huh.
Likewise, a very old roof, something that's getting 18 to 20 years, will start getting granules in there because now our asphalt coating is drying out and no longer in good condition and starts letting loose of the stones. There's always going to be some granule movement or loss on the shingles. Usually, you asked, Tom, how can we tell that the roof is bad?
Yeah, so what are the real telltale signs of a roof that needs replacing?
Once the mineral granules have come off of the shingle,
mm-hmm.
then the sun can start getting to the asphalt and to the mat. I usually figure if I can see pinpoint spots, little areas that are bare, that roof probably has less than 2 to 3 years. If we have large areas, that roof needs to be replaced almost immediately.
And they may be pretty evident at
that
point. Yeah.
But where I look... the older shingles where they have the 3/8 inch cut between the shingle tabs, look inside of there. When shingles are installed, they're actually installed in a what we call full double coverage. Mm-hmm. What you see of the shingle is only half of the shingle. So the shingle, the lower shingle goes up behind the upper shingle. So if you get a hole in a shingle tab, there is still a section of shingle underneath that, which is still repelling the water. And then underneath that, we have our roofing felt, which we were talking about earlier, either 15 or 30-pound felt paper,
right,
which is a water barrier, vapor barrier.
Itself is waterproof.
Yeah, it is. The felt paper is actually another asphalt paper, but it does not have the mineral granules, so it will not withstand any sunlight.
Mm-hmm.
Sunlight will deteriorate that in a matter of weeks, as a matter of fact. If you have somebody put a felt paper roof over the top of your new construction, you've only got a couple of weeks before the sunlight really starts deteriorating that paper because it doesn't have any UV protection.
Mm-hmm. Then what about the corners of the shingles turning upwards? Is that any sign that something may be about to go, or is that also kind of a false indicator?
I would say it's a false indicator because there are so many things that could create a little bit of shingle curl. An overheated attic or a high humidity in the attic, or a manufacturing defects.
Mm-hmm.
Any number of different things can cause a little bit of curling of the shingles. Now, excessive curling starts holding water, cupping, things like that. We can create problems. But for the most part, a little bit of curl is not necessarily an indication the shingle's wearing out. Well, the primary one is, okay, hey, what kind of condition are the granules in? Do I have any holes where the sunlight can get through there?
So the big thing is bare spots.
Yes.
You see some bare spots here and there, then you got to think about it.
For the most part, yeah. And particularly if the shingles are a second layer, they'll have a little bit of a crease where they go over the top of the old shingle, mm-hmm. and you'll end up with little lines, and those tabs will wear more rapidly.
All right. If anybody has any other questions that they may not have gotten to during the show or any other time, email, any way of contacting you?
Wait
till next month.
Which would be fine.
We'll welcome your question.
But. We can be reached at the Spies Home Inspection Office, which is 5048 here in Champaign-Urbana, or Spies Inspect@AOL.com.
Okay.
We'd be more than happy to answer most of the questions. My father, who started the business, is retired and sits in front of the computer on a regular basis. So feel free to send him those email questions.
And those of us who've been listening for a long time know Hank Spies was the original guest on the home repair and maintenance program. And he still answers questions.
Huh? Oh, yes. And actually, he was, I think, the original home inspector in the Champaign-Urbana area.
No kidding. So. All right. Well, there's some experience there if you have some more questions.
I wish I knew everything that he did.
Hank is not in front of the mic, but he's still getting those questions answered. Scott, nice to stop by again. We'll see you again in a month. David and Julie,
I'm looking forward to it. I always have a good time with our guests.
And we always have a lot of questions come in. So we're glad to be of service. And Scott, again, thanks for your time.